Okay, so I have a bit of a confession to make right off the bat here.
Oh boy, let's hear it.
When I first looked at the stack of documents for today's deep dive, I actually almost put it back in the pile.
Really? I mean, I guess it is pretty dense.
Yeah, well, on the surface, we are looking at this very niche, very technical log. It's from a DIY engineer who's just trying to buy something called a bus bar machine.
It doesn't exactly scream riveting narrative, does it?
No, not at all.
I'd wager most people don't even know what a bus bar is, let alone why you would need this massive, specialized hydraulic machine to bend one.
Right. It sounds like something, you'd only care about if you were wearing a hard hat and standing on a factory floor.
Exactly.
But then I started actually reading it, and maybe 3 pages in, I realized this isn't actually a story about bending copper at all.
It really isn't.
It is a complete masterclass in decision making. It's about how we lie to ourselves about budgets and how we misunderstand the physics of the things we try to build.
And we can't forget the twist.
Yes. The part that really got me. How a piece of cattle farming equipment called a cow crush somehow holds the absolute secret to smart procurement.
That is definitely the most bizarre twist in the source material.
How often do you see that?
Never. It is incredibly rare to find a document that seamlessly connects high voltage electrical manufacturing with, well, livestock restraint and non-woven bag making.
It sounds like a joke setup.
It does, but once you see the connection the author makes, you really can't unsee it. The logic is surprisingly universal.
So that is our mission today for this deep dive. We are unpacking a source titled My DIY Workshop Journey Through Bus Bar Machine Buying.
A very literal title.
Very literal. But we're going to use it to answer a much bigger question for you listening. How do you buy complex equipment, whether it's for a factory, a startup, or just your own garage, without completely losing your shirt?
And we should probably set the context for the listener right away.
Yeah, good idea.
The narrator here isn't some procurement officer at Boeing or Tesla with an unlimited corporate budget.
Definitely not.
This is a frustrated, DIY-minded engineer. They were just tired of using improvised tools, tired of their personal projects looking amateurish, and they decided to finally go down the rabbit hole to get a professional result on a personal scale.
And man, that rabbit hole is deep. The first thing that hits you in the text is what they call the base price trap.
Oh, that is a brutal trap.
I think anyone who has ever shopped for anything expensive, a car, a house, even enterprise software, knows this exact pain.
Absolutely.
The author admits their very first mistake was simply going online, Googling best bus bar machine, and sorting by price.
Which is the classic amateur move. We've all done it.
Oh, totally.
But when you search for a generic term like that, the internet just gives you pure chaos. They found everything from hand-cranked manual units for a few $100 to massive CNC-controlled industrial processing lines for $50,000.
And the crazy part is how they look online.
Right. On a computer screen, a JPEG of a $3,000 machine and a $30,000 machine can look suspiciously similar.
They both just look like big blue metal boxes with levers.
Exactly. They look the same, but the reality is brutal.
So the author put together this budget chart after the fact, based on their actual real-world spend. And this chart is the first major aha moment of our deep dive today.
It really is an eye-opener.
If you take away nothing else, take the stat. The sticker price of the machine was only about 55% of the total cost.
That number should literally be printed on the wall of every single purchasing department. 55%.
It's wild.
That means nearly half the money you spend has absolutely nothing to do with the physical object you are actually buying. It completely shatters the whole idea of staying within budget if you only look at the listing price.
Let's break down that other 45%. Where does the money actually go? Because I feel like normally, we think, okay, tax and shipping, maybe an extra 10%, but 45% is huge.
Well, the source breaks it down into what they cleverly call the invisible.
The invisibles.
Right. First, you have tooling and dies, which accounted for a massive 20% of the budget.
20% just on dies.
Because a bending machine is effectively just a really heavy paperweight if you don't have the specific metal dies to shape the material you're holding.
And I'm guessing they aren't universal.
Not at all. These aren't one size fits all. You need a completely different die for different bending radii or different material thicknesses.
Okay, so that's 20%.
Then you have shipping and customs at 12%, because remember, these are incredibly heavy, awkward items that usually have to come on wooden pallets.
Right, freight shipping isn't cheap.
And then installation and setup took another big chunk.
But wait, my absolute favorite line item from this chart, and I've never seen this in a formal budget document before, but I'm absolutely stealing it for my life, was the mistakes buffer.
Yes, the mistakes buffer. It's just brilliant self-awareness.
They allocated a full 3% of the total budget just for screwing up.
And the author notes, very dryly I might add, that this was not theoretical.
They actually used it.
They run right through it. They broke things. They bought the wrong hydraulic fluid. They wasted expensive copper material just testing the machine.
This really perfectly introduces the concept of total landed cost. We tend to think, I have $5,000, the machine is $4,800, I'm good to go.
Right, but according to this math, if you have $5,000 total, you should probably be looking at a machine that only costs about $2,500.
You are completely underwater otherwise.
Exactly. The author realized that a so-called cheap machine becomes incredibly expensive once you realize it doesn't come with copper-compatible dies.
Or it runs on the wrong voltage and you need to buy a massive power converter.
Or, and this is a really huge one, it has no local spare parts.
Oh, that's a nightmare.
If a seal blows on Tuesday and you have to wait 6 weeks for a replacement part to arrive from overseas, the machine's cost just skyrocketed in lost time and stalled projects.
So the author is drowning in specs, drowning in all these hidden costs. How did they actually pivot? How did they stop just staring at price tags and feeling completely overwhelmed?
Well, they stopped acting like a shopper and they started acting like a workflow designer.
Okay, workflow designer.
This is the massive shift. Instead of asking, what machine should I buy? They stepped back and asked, what is the actual job?
They wrote it out.
They literally matched the whole process out step by step. Measure, mark, cut, bend, punch, deburr.
It sounds so simple when you say it out loud, but it acts as an incredibly powerful filter.
It does. Once they listed those exact steps, they realized they didn't actually need some high-volume factory monster.
Right. They weren't running a 247 production line.
You know, they needed something for low to medium volume, but with really high repeatability. They didn't need blazing speed. They needed precision, and they needed the ability to physically fit the thing into a relatively small workshop.
And that filter instantly killed like 80% of the options that looked so good on paper but were entirely wrong for their actual workflow.
It cleared the noise immediately.
Speaking of workflow, let's get into the actual physical reality of this. Segment 2 of our deep dive is where the rubber meets the road, or I guess, where the metal meets the die.
Very fitting.
Because the author didn't just sit back and read brochures. They got their hands dirty and ran workshop trials. And this is where the intense physics lesson comes in.
It is a painful lesson in material science.
Very painful.
They started out with copper pipe, which the author refers to as their confidence material.
Because they'd used it before.
Right. They assumed because they had worked with it before in basic plumbing contexts, it would be super easy to adapt to this new high-pressure machine.
Spoiler alert for everyone listening. It was not easy. They kinked it immediately.
They destroyed it. And the physics behind why is actually fascinating. They were using the wrong size bender, and they were rushing the process.
Just trying to muscle through it.
Exactly. The big lesson they highlight here is that tool sizing matters more than force. You can't just muscle a piece of copper into a perfect 90-degree shape.
Yeah.
You have to support the walls of the metal correctly.
And this brings up that great distinction in the text. People confuse pipe and tube tools all the time.
Oh, constantly.
Wait, I have to stop you there for a second, because before reading this, I definitely thought pipe and tube were just two words for the exact same thing. You're saying they're different.
Dramatically different. And this misunderstanding burns people all the time in fabrication.
Okay, explain.
Pipe is measured by the inside diameter. Because a pipe is a vessel, you really only care about how much fluid or gas can flow through the inside of it.
That makes sense.
But tube is measured by the outside diameter. Because with a tube, you care about how big it physically is for structural reasons, like fitting it into a bracket.
Okay.
So a 1-inch pipe is actually physically larger on the outside than a 1-inch tube.
Wow.
If you try to use a pipe bender on a piece of tube, the die is going to be too loose. It doesn't hug the metal tightly enough. The pressure distributes unevenly, the walls of the metal collapse inward, and you get a nasty kink instead of a smooth curve.
That is a very expensive distinction to miss.
It is. And once they finally sorted that out, they moved on to testing stainless steel.
And if copper was tricky, stainless steel sounds, frankly, malicious.
It's incredibly stubborn. This is where they ran into the concept of springback.
I love this term, springback. It sounds like a wrestling move, but in the text, it's described almost like the metal has a memory of its own.
That's a perfect way to put it. When you bend a thick piece of stainless steel, you are physically stretching the outer fibers of the metal and compressing the inner fibers.
Right.
But the metal naturally wants to return to its original flat shape. It violently resists the change. You might push the hydraulic lever and bend it to exactly 90 degrees, but the second you release that pressure, the metal relaxes back to, say, 93 degrees.
So you're constantly fighting the material's desire to just be straight again.
Exactly. The author quickly realized that with harder materials, you have to literally overbend to compensate for that memory.
You bend it to 88 degrees, hoping it relaxes back to a perfect 90.
Yes. And if your machine doesn't allow for that fine-grain, incremental precision control, like if you just have a simple, dumb ONOFF switch, you can never get a perfect angle. You'll be fighting that spring back forever.
Man, that's frustrating. Then they tried rebar, which, from the sounds of it, is just pure brute force, and something called 4-inch RMC.
Right, rigid metal conduit. 4 inches of solid, thick metal pipe.
Just massive.
This was a huge reality check anecdote in the text. The author was helping a friend out and realized that you simply cannot use DIY garage-level tools for something like that. That requires heavy-duty professional hydraulic equipment.
It really highlighted a massive terminology problem for them.
It did. The author realized that going to a supplier and saying, I need a bending machine, is totally meaningless.
Because bending machine could mean almost anything.
Exactly. If you're doing flat sheet metal, you need a press brake.
Mm-hmm.
If you're doing round tube, you need a rotary draw bender.
Okay.
And if you're doing bus bar, which again is a thick, flat strip of conductive copper, you need a very specific bus bar bender. Mixing these up is just an incredibly expensive way to buy a machine that does absolutely nothing for you.
One of the really specific debates the author gets into next, and this felt like a real inside baseball moment for fabricators, is the order of operations.
The chicken and egg problem.
Exactly. Do you punch the holes first, or do you bend the metal first?
It's a classic age-old fabrication debate.
And what did they find?
The author found that punching the holes before bending is usually the better route because it's so much easier to measure and reference a flat piece of metal.
That makes sense.
If you bend it into a complex shape first, good luck trying to use a ruler to measure exactly where the hole goes on a curved three-dimensional surface.
But there's a catch, right? There's always a catch in this document.
There is always a catch. If the hole is punched too close to where the bend actually happens, what they call the deformation zone, the hole will get stretched out into an ugly oval shape.
Oh, because the metal is stretching.
The metal literally flows and pulls during the bend. So you have to plan the geometry perfectly. But what really stood out to me in this section was their experience with a borrowed punch setup.
Oh, right.
They made a hole, but it came out all burred, jagged, and just ugly.
And naturally, they blamed the machine initially.
We always blame the tool first. It's human nature.
Always.
But they took a closer look and realized it was actually a worn-out punch die and a rushed, sloppy alignment by the operator.
So it's operator error.
It completely reinforces a recurring theme in this text. Setup quality is just as important as machine quality.
Right.
You can buy the absolute best, most expensive machine in the world, but if your punch is dull or you don't take the time to align it perfectly, you are going to get garbage output.
Okay. This brings us to the absolute most unexpected part of the source material.
Here we go.
We've covered material physics. We've covered hidden budget traps. Now we have to talk about cows.
Yes. The cow crush analogy.
For you listening who, like me, might not be completely up to speed on your agricultural lingo, a cow crush is that heavy metal cage they use on farms to hold cattle perfectly still for vet exams.
Very robust equipment.
Very. The author was helping a friend evaluate and buy one, and they had this epiphany that evaluating a cow crush is basically the exact same process as evaluating a high-tech bus bar machine.
It sounds totally absurd on its face, but the logic actually holds up perfectly.
Walk us through it.
With the cow crush, the price varied wildly based on whether it was manual versus hydraulic operation, the finish like, whether it was cheap paint or fully galvanized, and of course, safety features.
Right.
But the major realization the author had was that you shouldn't look at what the machine does. You should look at how it fails.
That's the quote, what breaks first?
That is the golden question. When you look at a glossy brochure, you just see the shiny features and the best case scenarios.
Yeah, the marketing fluff.
But when you ask what breaks first, you are forcing yourself to look at the machine's actual life cycle. For the cow crush, the answer is the hinges and the gate latches, because you have a terrified 8,000-pound animal repeatedly slamming its weight into them.
Makes total sense. And for the busbar machine?
For the busbar machine, it's the hydraulic seals and the bending dies.
Because that hydraulic system is under immense, immense pressure over and over again.
Exactly. If you don't ask the vendor about the serviceability of those specific seals, you aren't buying a tool, you are just buying a future headache. It shifted the author's entire perspective from chasing performance to prioritizing durability.
They also brought up a non-woven bag-making machine. This is another weird comparison they made to their busbar search.
Yes.
What on earth does making reusable shopping bags have to do with bending thick copper?
This specific comparison was all about speed and the true cost of downtime. In the commercial packaging world, profit margins are razor thin. If the bag machine stops for even a minute, you're actively losing money every single second. The key metric they lived by there was bags per minute.
And how did that translate to the guy in his garage with the busbar machine?
It translated to cycles per hour. The author realized that a machine isn't expensive just because of the initial price tag. It becomes ruinously expensive when it cannot maintain a steady output.
So uptime is everything.
Right. If you save $2,000 buying the cheaper machine, but the thing jams every 50 cycles or the hydraulic pump overheats and forces you to take a 20-minute cool-down break, you're going to lose that $2,000 in wasted labor costs within the first month.
That is such a smart way to frame it. And this led the author to create their final evaluation framework.
The master table.
Yeah, it's a big table right in the source material. It lists build quality, throughput, repeatability, serviceability, and operator safety.
And you have to notice the price isn't the top line on that framework.
It's not even close to the top.
Operator safety is a massive one that gets completely overlooked in the initial budget phase.
Because safety doesn't seem to have a direct ROI on paper.
Exactly.
Yep.
But a machine that feels unsafe makes your operator slow and hesitant because they are constantly worried about losing a finger.
Naturally.
And that hesitation slows down the entire workflow, which costs you money.
So we've gone from base prices to kinking copper to restraining cows. It's been quite a journey. But we really need to know, what did they actually buy?
The million-dollar question.
After all this intense research, all these physics experiments and budget spreadsheets, did they bite the bullet and buy the $50,000 industrial monster?
They didn't.
Oh.
No, and they didn't buy the cheap wholesale listing either. They ended up choosing a very solid mid-range busbar processing setup.
The Goldilocks choice.
Pretty much. It offered really good frame rigidity. And crucially, it had repeatable angle control, so they could actually manage that nasty springback issue we talked about earlier.
But they did do something else really interesting. They didn't just buy one big machine.
No, they adopted what they called a hybrid approach. And honestly, this feels like a very mature, experienced decision.
What did they do?
They bought the mid-range stationary machine to keep in the workshop, but they also carved out budget to buy a smaller, portable hydraulic bender strictly for field work.
Why split the budget in half like that? Wouldn't it be better to just buy one slightly better machine?
Because they finally recognize the actual physical reality of their work.
Right, the workflow.
Sometimes you absolutely need the heavy precision of the workshop machine to make perfect, identical parts in a controlled environment. But sometimes you are out on a dirty job site, squeezed into a tiny, poorly lit electrical room, and you just need to quickly bend a piece of copper to make it fit right then and there.
And the big workshop machine can't do that.
Trying to force one machine to do both of those completely different jobs usually results in a setup that does neither job well.
It's avoiding the Swiss Army knife syndrome, you know, where you have a single tool that technically does everything, but does it all incredibly poorly.
Precisely. It was a purchasing decision entirely driven by the workflow rather than being driven by the spec sheet.
Before we wrap up, I really want to touch on the hidden issues the author lists at the very end of the document.
Oh, these are great.
These are the things that are never, ever listed on the product page. My absolute favorite one is the machine footprint versus the operator footprint.
That is such a hilarious but painful visualization.
The author fully admits they once placed a machine so that it fit absolutely perfectly into the room's dimensions.
A perfect Tetris fit.
Right. But when the human operator actually stepped up and tried to use it, they were completely trapped against the wall.
Just pinned against the drywall trying to desperately work a heavy hydraulic lever.
It's so funny, but it's a classic failure to simulate the actual workflow.
You measure the base of the machine, but you completely forget that a human being needs to stand there, move their arms around, and swing a really long, heavy piece of copper through the air.
And noise levels. That was another big hidden issue.
A huge factor, especially in a small enclosed workshop. If turning on the machine sounds like a 747 jet taking off, you rapidly fatigue your operator.
You can't think, you can't hear yourself, you can't communicate with anyone.
Exactly. But you will never see a metric like decibel level under full load listed on a cheap machine's promotional flyer.
Never. And then there's chip management. Dealing with the little metal scraps sounds so trivial.
It's definitely the unsexy side of manufacturing.
Yeah.
But if you don't plan for where those sharp metal shavings actually go when they leave the die, your operator ends up standing knee-deep in a pile of jagged debris.
Which is a huge safety hazard.
It's a safety hazard, and it's a massive cleanup nightmare at the end of every shift. The author noted that better, well-thought-out machines have integrated catch trays or chutes.
Which shows that the manufacturer actually thought about the real person using the tool, not just the task the tool performs.
Exactly.
So if we pull back here and look at the big picture of this whole journey, we started with a guy just trying to figure out how to bend some copper in his garage.
And we ended up with an intense lesson on total landed cost, material physics, and life cycle analysis.
The author really sums it up perfectly with one sentence near the end that I think is the absolute core of this entire deep dive. They wrote, "I thought I was buying a busbar machine, but I was really designing a workflow."
That is the ultimate takeaway right there. The machine is ultimately just a dumb tool used to execute a process.
Right.
If you don't intimately understand the process first, the exact measure, cut, bend, punch sequence, you simply cannot buy the right tool. The author evolved from being a passive shopper to being an active designer of their own work environment.
It effectively completely kills the idea of casually browsing for industrial equipment. You have to know exactly what you need before you even open a catalog or look at what they have to sell you.
Absolutely. The source ends with a really strong call to get specific. Don't just ask a vendor, "How much is your bending machine?"
Right. Ask better questions.
Ask them, "What implies the cost of downtime on this specific model?" Ask yourself, "What is my realistic mistake buffer?" Ask the engineer, "What exactly happens to my production line when the hydraulic seals blow?"
It honestly makes me want to go look at my own budget for my next work-end project, even if it's just a simple home renovation, and forcefully add a mistakes buffer line item.
I think we could all use a permanent 3% mistakes buffer in our lives, honestly.
Minimum 3%. So for you listening, here is the question we want to leave you with today.
A little food for thought.
Exactly. This author avoided an expensive disaster by looking way beyond the shiny brochure. So in your own work, or even in your personal life, where are you comparing specs when you really should be looking at the workflow? Where are you trying to buy the quote-unquote best thing without ever actually defining what the job is?
And are you truly accounting for the hidden cost of downtime? Or are you just blindly looking at the cost of purchase? Because as we clearly learned from the bag machine and the cow crush today, long-term reliability is almost always cheaper than a low sticker price.
That is a great thought to end on. Remember, measure twice, cut once, and maybe double check if your operator physically fits between the machine and the wall before you bolt it to the floor. Thanks for diving in with us.
Until next time.